Welcome back, everybody, and good afternoon. My name is Andrew Severin. I am at Iowa State University, and I am the new facility manager for a genome informatics facility at Iowa State that was created in September. Today, I'll be talking about the application of RNA-seq technology in soybean crop improvement. I'm going to start out by talking about an RNA-seq atlas that we created from 14 libraries of next-generation sequencing data that covered flower, shell, pod, seven stages of seed development, leaf, root, and nodule. And the main point I want to emphasize is that with this high-throughput sequencing data, we get back so much of this data that trying to interpret that data in a meaningful way and trying to visualize that can be quite challenging. One of the first things we did was took these 14 libraries of short-read sequences and aligned it to the soybean genome, and then from there extracted gene expression counts from that alignment. And one of the first analyses that we performed was a hierarchical clustering of that gene expression data as it corresponded to each tissue type. So as you can see here, the seed tissues all clustered together. So in soybean, there are 66,210 genes that are annotated based on the most current release of soybean. And each of these tissues has a unique transcriptional profile. Each gene has a different gene expression. And you can visualize each of these tissues as a 66,000 vector of values. And their similarity is expressed here in this dendrogram. And you can see that the seeds are more similar to respect to each other from 10 days after flowering to 42 days after flowering. And they're more similar to the aerial organs, these pods, these shells, and young leaf and flower. And seed and aerial organs are more similar than root and nodule. And this is actually follows suits very well with other known literature of Metacago. Another analysis that we performed to try to understand and visualize this massive amount of data was to look at the most highly expressed genes. So what you're actually seeing here is a heat map of the top 500 expressed genes. So on the left-hand side, you can see the relatedness of each of those genes and their expression profile among the 14 tissues. If you're not familiar with a heat map, you can look at the color coding corresponds to the number of reads that each gene has in a particular tissue. So zero read count is white, and this is a log2 RPKM normalized, and that purple would correspond to the several hundred thousand read counts for a specific gene that we're looking at. And what falls out immediately from this particular image is that of those 500 genes that are highly expressed, you have some, there's a cluster here, in seed that are specific to the seed tissue. And again, similarly, you have a cluster of genes that are specific to nodules. And when you look at the annotation for these genes that are specific to seed, you see they correspond to very well-known seed-filling proteins or seed-filling genes, and similarly the leg hemoglobins in the nodules. Well, the group that I was working with and collaborating with, Randy Shoemaker, they are interested in understanding the seed-filling process and trying to understand what genes are involved in seed-filling to try to improve the health, quality, and quantity of soybean yield. So in order to get a better grasp of what genes might be involved in this process, I wanted to try to identify all genes, not necessarily just specific to seed expression, but had at least a higher expression in seed over all nine seed tissues. I did this by doing a Fisher exact test that were FDR corrected 0.05. And you can imagine that I would pick up all these uniquely expressed seed genes, but you'd also pick up genes where you see a slightly higher expression in at least two of these or one of these seed tissues over all non-seed tissues. You can see it's a darker green over the other non-seed tissues. When I did this, I came up with 2,036 genes. And when you try to create a dendrogram of those genes, quite honestly, you can't make heads or tails of it because there's so much information here and it's so densely packed that you'd have to go one by one and try to figure out what these expression profiles look like. And this really exemplifies the difficulties we have in trying to visualize such immense amounts of data. The solution that I came up with was to combine the seed dendrogram with a box plot, which is what I call a box plot dendrogram. And when I did this, you can see that the three major clades, 1, 2, and 3, actually correspond to early seed development, late seed development, and fairly consistent seed throughout seed development. So you have higher expression throughout seed expression, and late seed development and early seed development. And if we look more particularly in those genes that we're interested in, I realize this is kind of small, I can't really see this. There's 18 genes that are annotated with nutrient reservoir activity. So these conglycinins, these genes that are very important in the seed filling process. Turns out that 12 of them correspond or are found in this clade 21G. And this clade has 177 genes. So 12 of them have known seed filling properties, seed filling genes that are very well known and established. But there's also another 165 genes that have very similar expression profiles to those that are well known. So what are these 165 other genes doing? Many of which, about 40%, are not annotated because all of our annotation currently comes from Arabidopsis. So already with this RNA-seq atlas that we have of these 4T tissues and is specifically in the seed development process, we've identified candidate genes that we can go and explore further and try to get an idea as to what their roles are in the seed filling process and potentially improve soybean quality and help. This was all put into a website that you can access at soybase.org/soyseq. And one of the features I wanted to be sure was included in this website was a search box so that you can type in your favorite gene or gene family and select raw normalized counts, hit the search button, and return back the expression values for all 14 tissues. In order to really make great use of all of this next generation sequencing technology and this information, we need to be better at disseminating that information. And one of those tools would be to generate websites or repositories that we can put this data so it's more easily accessible. Another project that I want to discuss, I want to really bring out, is how we can use RNA-seq and look at these abiotic stress tolerances. So if you are interested in looking at a particular quantitative trait and you have a particular loci that you're looking at, how can you use RNA-seq and next-generation sequencing data to gain insight and understanding of the particular trait you're interested in? I'm going to cover a trait that the Shoemaker group was interested in, this iron deficiency chlorosis. It causes yellowing of the leaves during iron stress and affects many crop species. Despite the fact that it's extremely abundant in the Earth's crust, and this is because at high pHs, plants have a very difficult time absorbing iron. And so I used next-generation sequencing to try to understand better this IDC phenotype in soybean. So there are 11 known quantitative trait loci in soybean. The one I'll be focusing on in the 20 chromosomes here, these are the Central American locations, is on the long arm of chromosome 3. The experimental workflow, so we took total RNA, and this was sent for a DNA sequencing down at NCGR, and those short read sequences that we got back, the very many millions and gigs of sequencing data that we get back, was aligned to the soybean genome that was solved in 2010 using GSNAP, but for those that are familiar, there's also SOAP or Top Hat that you can also use. This generates a SAM file, which then can be used to identify SNPs and insertions and deletions and also do differential gene expression to get differential gene expression and be used for integration mapping, which when you combine together, you can identify or hope to identify candidate genes that are responsible in that region that are responsible for the phenotype, in this case, iron deficiency chlorosis. An iron recovery experiment was designed, and this was performed on two neurocygenic lines. This is Clark and isoclark. Clark is the iron efficient phenotype. Isoclark is the phenotype that has the integration on the long arm of chromosome 3 that is responsible for the iron deficiency in soybean. And these Two plants were grown in replicate for 10 days in iron-limiting conditions with a control, and then after 10 days, this iron-limiting condition was removed and allowed to recover for 4 days. So we have a 10-day limiting and then a 4-day recovery. And what I wanted to try to identify were those genes that were turned on during iron stress and then recovered or turned off during the recovery state. I wanted to see what that would result in. Like, what are these two neurogenic lines behaving in a similar fashion? Are there transcriptional profiles? Those genes that are differentially expressed, are they similar? If they are similar, then you'd expect that the genes that are underlying this particular quantitative trait are downstream of the transcription factors. So if it's a transcription factor, you'd expect that the number of differentially expressed genes to be extremely different between these two lines. And when we did this, we found that Clark and Esso-Clark had very different gene expression profiles at the same states. And so this suggested that, in fact, it was a transcription factor. And this was actually supported with other experimental evidence that was done by Jamie O'Rourke in previous literature. So I went ahead and looked at those transcription factors, and there are 5,674 transcription factors in the soybean genome. Of those, 222 are differentially expressed between the 10-day stress versus the control. But as a bioinformatician and as somebody that was raised in a wet lab, I know for a fact that if you go back and give somebody and say it's one of these 222 genes, they'll look at you and probably bonk you on the head, because there's no way to really experimentally test 222 genes in a time-efficient manner. So I need to narrow that down to a more reasonable number that you could go in and experimentally test and or confirm. And to do that, I went and wound up trying to narrow the introgression. So using the SNP data that we got from these short read sequences, you can use a bootstrap method to identify clusters of genes, clusters of SNPs that have a higher density than you'd expect by random chance for any 500 kb section. So what you're seeing here are the chromosomes 3, 4, 5, 8, 13, and 16. Here are the centromeric locations, and each one of these boxes corresponds to 500 kb of the soybean genome. The numbers corresponding on top are the number of SNPs located in that region. And if you see a box, that means it's at least 3 standard deviations above what you'd expect by random chance, given the same number of SNPs on the chromosome. And as you can see here, it picks up the major introgression that was already known on chromosome 3, but also identifies several smaller introgressions that were previously unknown. What's really kind of exciting about this technique is that it doesn't necessarily limit itself to neurogenic lines. If you have two lines you want to cross, you can look at the offspring and tell what sections of the genome came from which parent using the same technique. But in this case, we're looking at neurogenic lines. I wanted to narrow down the introgression on the long arm of chromosome 3 to try to identify what transcription factors are present within that region. When I did that, I found that only 8 of the 222 were both differentially expressed and localized to that region on the long arm of chromosome 3. And this is a much more reasonable number. This is something that you could go into the lab and test, but I still wanted to find the one or two that were the most promising candidate genes. And to do this, I went ahead and looked at the SNPs and insertions and deletions. And I found one gene that had a 12-base deletion that corresponded to 4 amino acids, this proline, glutamate, leucine, and glutamine. And that particular gene, this GLAMA03G28610, corresponds to a basic helix-loop-helix transcription factor, which has been believed to be, or at least this type of transcription factor has been believed to be involved, but I wasn't sure which one and where. It interacts with FIT, which upregulates the main strategy 1 iron deficiency chlorosis response. So already, just from the SNP data, the localization of the transcription factors, this looks like a very promising candidate for the underlying mechanism. But I didn't want to stop there. My background is in NMR spectroscopy, so I understand protein structure. And I wanted to try to figure out if I could look at the protein structure and say, does it make sense that this mutation would have a large effect on the transcription factor and or its binding? So I went ahead and took this gene and aligned it to the known genes in the protein database that have known structures. And when I did that and looked at it in PIMOL, you get a structure that looks like this. Here in blue is the gene that I identified. Purple is this fit. You've got the DNA in orange. And you have this deletion, these four residues, in green. Based on the protein biochemistry, we know that every 3.6 residues is one turn of the helix. With four residues, we're looking at about a 5 angstrom just movement of this helix. So what you have are these two transcription factors coming together, and either it's binding the DNA, and then it can't lock properly, or it's locking, but it can't bind the DNA properly, potentially, as a model for why this transcription factor isn't working. So bioinformatics is not the end-all. It's not a panacea. All this next-generation sequencing technology is only a tool in your toolkit for doing scientific research. If anybody tells you that RNA-seq and next-generation sequencing will solve all your problems, they're lying to you. Because quite honestly, you have to go back into the lab and confirm everything that you do. And so while I was doing this, a very promising, very good graduate student in the Shoemaker group, Greg Piper, went and looked at the integration and narrowed the integration using more traditional methods by crossing Clark and isoclark, the iron efficient and inefficient lines, and genotyping in that region. So this is the integration on chromosome 3. Genotyped all the offspring based on satellite markers that he found that were polymorphic across that region. So he found one offspring that had a iron inefficient genotype here and an iron efficient genotype for the rest of the region. 2 for this genotype and so 10 for this one and so forth. He found a few that didn't have any plants. When he, actually before I get to that, the gene that I identified using bioinformatics is right here, right next to satellite marker 387. And when he correlated this with the phenotyping, he found a strong correlation between satellite marker 387 with this iron deficiency chloroses phenotype. Now, it's not a perfect match, but this is a quantitative trait. And you'll notice that the gene that was identified using bioinformatics is right next to satellite marker 387. So to recap, using next-generation sequencing data and bioinformatics, I was able to identify candidate genes that are potentially responsible for the IDC in soybean. This was accomplished by narrowing down the quantitative trait loci region using SNPs and integration mapping and differential gene expression and biology to identify likely candidate genes. And then further, a case was built using the SNPs and protein modeling. And all this was experimentally confirmed using satellite markers and showed that the satellite marker 387 was tightly linked with the gene that was identified and the phenotype. I just want to kind of end this on a note that says that in the next 5 years, I can only see this problem getting worse on visualization. And as a community, we really need to come together and build better infrastructure. We need to communicate better between labs, between individuals, to build these support tools, to provide better access to the data that is publicly available. And we need better communication between scientists and computer programmers. We need to be able to bridge that gap. And for that reason, it's one of the reasons I took the position at the Genome Informatics Facility. And here are some of the projects that I plan on building pipelines for to try to encourage this infrastructure building. If anybody here is currently writing a grant or is interested in working on a project with me, I'd be more than happy to speak with you afterwards as well. So with that, I just wanted to acknowledge Randy Shoemaker and Stephen Cannon and Greg Pfeiffer, the graduate student on this project, the individuals at NCGR that did sequencing, Greg May and Andrew Farmer, and some collaborators at University of Minnesota, Carol Vance and Bob Stupar.
Me.
That's actually a good question. I know that there are some communities that are out there already. So if you haven't been to seekanswers.com and you're looking for some basic information, that would be a good way to start. If you are currently involved in either bioinformatics for a lab or in a core unit, I'd be interested in speaking with you. I'd like to get together a listserv of some sort for the individuals that are heading up these kind of facilities and trying to share some of our scripts and or programs, ideas, have a more centralized location for asking questions that is at a much higher level than you would expect at something like seekanswers.com. Does that answer your question? You still seem a little... Okay. Yes? It was a T203. I don't know if that is any information for you, but that was the main source. It's I know that there might be some shared genetic diversity with NOCA, if that so. I believe Greg Pfeiffer did do some other crossing, and he's spearheading the paper. He'll be first author on this. And that hopefully will come out either later this year or early next year. Yes?
Yeah, I have a question. Now I know the RNA sequence profiler very well. So I want to, do you have any idea how can we explore the position of sources?
How can we explore what? I'm sorry.
More RNA sequences that
yes.
are available.
Yes.
So how can we to explore this resources? Yeah. So that we can find that we need to do to sequence every RNA with based on other bodies data.
There's a lot. So
how can we explore it?
How do you explore all this data? And honestly, we need more bioinformaticians that understand more than just the tools, but can actually understand the scientific biological questions at hand. I was just relaying this to somebody over lunch. It's kind of, we need more teams. I mean, it used to be that we needed 20 scientists to sequence a genome. Now we need one person with a machine and 20 people to analyze the results. But just as important, you can't just hire any computer scientist, any programmer, because it'd be equivalent to a mechanic that knows every single tool in the toolbox but doesn't know how to diagnose a problem, doesn't know how to ask the questions to diagnose what's wrong with your car. He might be very good with the tools he has at hand, but unless you can understand the car, or in this case the organism, and the implications of polyploidy, for instance, in soybean or other organisms, that there's so many assumptions that are made. It's a lot of just spanning that gap, as I mentioned.
Your experiment, your sequence, one is a control, another is a messenger, right? So, only two genotypes your sequence then?
They were aligned to Williams 82 sequence. And then I think the question is getting at how do we know that the individuals were polymorphic and not just polymorphic to the Williams 82? And the way you do that is you just filter out those that have the same. So you look for all SNPs that were between the lines, between the neurocergenic lines, and then you filter out for those that are the same between the two. So they are truly polymorphic. So you align it to the sequence, and if they both happen to have the same polymorphism to Williams 82, you just throw that out. If they have different ones, then you say that, oh, they're polymorphic with respect to each other.
Yeah, but I mean, because they only have two sequences. One is control, another is mutant. So, both the two sequence data, because in the mutant, maybe a lot of development or other environment factors will influence your sequence result. If you only have two.
Well, there's two neurocergenic. The neurocergenic lines are crossed between T203 and Williams 82, and there was a region that was introgressed into Williams 82. So the region that, after seven generations of backcrossing, that region has quite a few polymorphic SNPs between itself and Williams 82.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure if I... We can talk afterwards. It sounds to me like we have to move on, but thank you.